earlier that three lawyers were far too many for one secretary when his email chimed with a note from the federal court clerk. He opened the email and found an answer to their amended complaint. His eyes went straight to the attorney register, straight to the name of Nadine Karras of Rogan Rothberg, and he felt faint. David had never met her, but he certainly knew her by reputation. She was famous throughout the entire Chicago bar. She tried and won the biggest cases of all. He had never uttered a recorded word in court. But there they were, names listed together as if they were equals. For the plaintiffs, Wallace T. Figg, B. Oscar Finley, David E. Zink of the firm of Finley and Figg, along with S. Jerry Alessandros of the firm of Zell and Potter. And for Varick Laboratories, Nadine L. Karras and R. Luther Hotchkin of the firm Rogan Rothberg. On paper, David looked as if he belonged in the game. He read the answer slowly. The obvious facts were admitted. All liability was denied. Overall, it was a straightforward, almost benign response to a $100 million lawsuit, and it was not what they had anticipated. According to Wally, the first response from Varick would be a vicious motion to dismiss, accompanied by a weighty brief prepared by bright Ivy Leaguers who toiled in the firm's research department. The motion to dismiss would cause a significant skirmish, but they would prevail because such motions were rarely granted, according to Wally. Along with the answer, the defense filed a set of basic interrogatories that sought personal information about each of the eight dead clients and their families, and requested the names and general testimonies of the expert witnesses. As far as David knew, they had yet to hire experts, though Jerry Alessandros was believed to be in charge of that. Ms. Karras also wanted to take the eight depositions as soon as possible. According to the clerk, a hard copy of the answer and other filings was in the mail. David heard heavy footsteps on the stairs. Wally's. He lumbered in, panting, and said, "You see what they filed?" "Just read it," David answered. "Seems rather tame, don't you think?" "What do you know about litigation?" "Ouch. Sorry, something's up. I gotta call Alessandros and figure this thing out." "It's just a simple answer and some discovery. Nothing to panic over." "Who's panicked? You know this woman. It is your old law firm." "Never met her, but she's supposed to be terrific in the courtroom." "Yeah, well, so is Alessandros, but we ain't going to court." He said this with a noticeable lack of conviction. He left the office mumbling and stomped down the stairs. A month had passed since they had filed the lawsuit, and Wally's dreams of a quick gold strike were fading. It looked as though they would be required to do a little work before the settlement talks began. 10 minutes later, David received an email from the junior partner. It read, "Can you get started on those interrogatories? I got to run down to the funeral home." "Sure, Wally. I'd love to."
Chapter 18. The minor charges against Tripp were eventually dropped due to a lack of interest, though the court did require him to sign a statement promising to stay away from the firm of Finley and Figg and its lawyers. Tripp vanished, but his ex-girlfriend did not. Deanna arrived minutes before 5 p.m., her usual time. On this day, she was dressed like a cowgirl, skin-tight jeans, boots with pointed toes, a tight red blouse upon which she had neglected to fasten the top three buttons. "Is Wally in?" she cooed at Rochelle, who couldn't stand her. The cloud of perfume caught up with her and settled into the room, causing A.C. to sniff, then growl and retreat even farther under the desk. "He's in," Rochelle said dismissively. "Thanks, dear," Deanna said, trying to irritate Rochelle as much as possible. She strutted to Wally's office and entered without knocking. A week earlier, Rochelle had instructed her to sit and wait like all the other clients. It was becoming apparent, though, that she had far more clout than the other clients, at least as far as Wally was concerned. Once inside the office, Deanna walked into the arms of her lawyer, and after a long kiss with an embrace and the obligatory fondle, Wally said, "You look great, baby." "All for you, baby," she said. Wally checked to make sure the door was locked, then returned to his swivel chair behind his desk. "I need to make two calls, then we're out of here," he said, drooling. "Anything, baby," she cooed. Then she took a seat and pulled out a celebrity gossip magazine. She read nothing else and was as dumb as a rock, but Wally didn't care. He refused to judge her. She'd had four husbands. He'd had four wives. Who was he to pass judgment? Right now, they were in the process of trying to kill each other in bed, and Wally had never been happier. Outside, Rochelle was tidying up her desk, anxious to leave now that that hooker was in Mr. Figg's office, and who knew what they were doing in there. Oscar's door opened, and he emerged, holding some paperwork. "Where's Figg?" he asked, looking at Figg's closed door.
"In there with a client," Rochelle said. "Door's bolted and locked."
"Don't tell me."
"Yep, third day in a row."
"Are they still negotiating his fee?"
"Don't know. He must have raised it."
Though the fee was small, just a typical no-fault divorce case, Oscar was due a portion of it, but he wasn't sure how to get his split when half was being paid on the sofa. He stared at Wally's door for a moment, as if waiting for the sounds of passion, and, hearing none, turned to Rochelle and waved the papers.
"Have you read this?"
"What is it?"
"It's our agreement with Jerry Alessandros and Zell and Potter. 8 pages long, lots of fine print, already signed by my junior partner, obviously without being read in its entirety. Says here that we must contribute $25,000 to help front the litigation expenses. Figg never mentioned this to me."
Rochelle shrugged. It was lawyer business, not hers. But Oscar was hot.
"Further, it says that we get a fee of 40% on each case, half of which goes to Zell and Potter. But in the fine print, it says that a fee of 6% is paid to the plaintiff's litigation committee, a little bonus to the big shots for their hard work, and the 6% comes off the top of the settlement and out of our portion. So, as I figure it, we lose 6% off the top, and that gives us 34% to split with Alessandros, who of course will get a chunk of the 6%. Does this make sense to you, Ms. Gibson?"
"No. That makes two of us. We're getting screwed right and left, and now we must put up $25,000 for litigation expenses?"
Oscar's cheeks were red, and he kept looking at Wally's door, but Wally was safe inside. David came down the steps and walked into the conversation.
"Have you read this?" Oscar asked angrily, waving the contract.
"What is it?"
"Our contract with Zell and Potter."
"I looked over it," David said. "It's pretty straightforward."
"Oh, it is? Did you read the part about the $25,000 upfront money for expenses?"
"Yes, and I asked Wally about that. He said we'd probably just go to the bank, hit the firm's line of credit, then pay it back when we settle."
Oscar looked at Rochelle, who looked back at Oscar. Both were thinking, what line of credit? Oscar started to speak, then abruptly wheeled around and returned to his office, slamming the door after himself.
"What's that all about?" David asked.
"We don't have a line of credit," Rochelle said. "Mr. Finley's worried that the Crayox litigation will backfire and kill us financially. This wouldn't be the first time one of Figg's schemes blew up in our faces, but it could certainly be the biggest."
David glanced around and took a step closer.
"Can I ask you something in confidence?"
"I don't know," she said, taking a cautious step back.
"These guys have been at this game for a long time. 30+ years for Oscar, 20+ for Wally. Do they have some money stashed away somewhere? You don't see any around the office, so I figured they must have some buried."
Rochelle glanced around too, then said, "I don't know where the money goes when it leaves here. I doubt if Oscar has a dime because his wife spends everything. She thinks she's a cut or two above and wants to play that game. Wally, who knows? I suspect he's as broke as I am. But they do own the building free and clear."
David couldn't help but look at the cracks in the ceiling plaster.
"Let it go," he told himself.
"Just curious," David said. There was a shriek of female laughter from deep inside Mr. Figg's office.
"I'm leaving," David said, grabbing his overcoat.
"Me too," Rochelle said.
Everyone was gone when Wally and Deanna emerged. They quickly turned off the lights, locked the front door, and got in her car. Wally was delighted to have not only a new squeeze, but also one who was willing to drive. He had 6 weeks left on his suspension, and with Crayox so hot, he needed to be mobile. Deanna had jumped at the chance to earn referral fees, $500 cash for a death case and $200 for a non-death. But what really thrilled her was listening to Wally's predictions of taking down Varick Labs in a massive settlement that would bring in huge fees for him, and perhaps something for her as well, though this wasn't exactly out in the open yet. More often than not, their pillow talk drifted away to the world of Crayox and all it could mean. Her third husband had taken her to Maui, and she loved the beach. Wally had already promised a vacation in paradise. At that stage of their involvement, Wally would have promised her anything.
"Where to, dear?" she said, racing away from the office.
She was a dangerous driver in a little Mazda convertible, and Wally knew his chances would be slim in a collision.
"Just take it easy," he said, ratcheting down the seatbelt. "Let's go north toward Evanston."
"Are we hearing from these people?" she asked.
"Oh, yes, lots of phone calls."
And Wally wasn't lying. His cell phone rang constantly with inquiries from people who had picked up his little "Beware of Crayox" brochure. He had printed 10,000 and was littering Chicago with them. He tacked them on bulletin boards in Weight Watchers' meeting rooms, VFW posts, bingo parlors, hospital waiting rooms, and the restrooms of fast food restaurants, anywhere the shrewd mind of Wally Figg thought there might be people battling high cholesterol.
"So, how many cases do we have?" she asked.
Wally did not miss the "we" part of her question. He wasn't about to tell her the truth.
8 death cases, several hundred non-death, but they have to be tested first. I'm not sure every non-death case is really a case. Gotta find some damage to the heart before we take on the case."
"How do you do that?" They were flying along the Stevenson, dodging traffic, most of which she didn't appear to notice. Wally was ducking with each near miss.
"Take it easy, Deanna. We're not in a hurry," he said.
"You're always bitching about my driving," she said as she gave him a long, sad look.
"Just watch the road and slow down."
She eased off the gas and pouted for a few minutes.
"As we were saying, how do you know if these people have been damaged?"
"We'll hire a doctor to screen them. Crayox weakens the heart valves, and there are some tests that can tell us if a client has been harmed by the drug."
"How much are the tests?" she asked.
While he was noticing a growing curiosity into the economics of their Crayox litigation, and it was slightly irksome.
"About $1,000 a pop," he said, though he had no idea.
Jerry Alessandros had assured him that Zell and Potter had already retained the services of several doctors who were screening potential clients. These doctors would be made available to Finley and Figg in the near future, and once the testing began, their pool of non-death clients would expand greatly. Alessandros was on a jet every day zipping across the country, meeting with lawyers like Wally, piecing together big lawsuits here and there, hiring experts, plotting trial strategies, and, most important, hammering away at Varick and its lawyers. Wally felt honored to be a player in such a high-stakes game.
"That's a lot of money," Deanna said.
"Why are you so concerned about the money?" Wally snapped, glancing down at her unbuttoned cowgirl shirt.
"I'm sorry, Wally. You know, I'm the nosy type. This is all so exciting and stuff, and, well, it'll be so awesome when Varick starts writing those big checks."
"That could be a long way off. Let's just concentrate on rounding up the clients." At the Finley home, Oscar and his wife Paula were watching a MASH rerun on cable when they were suddenly confronted with the shrill voice and anxious face of a lawyer named Bosch, who was no stranger to cable commercials in the Chicago market. For years, Bosch had been pleading for car wrecks and tractor-trailer accident victims and cases involving asbestos and other products, and now, evidently, Bosch had become an expert on Crayox. He thundered on about the dangers of the drug and said vile things about Varick Labs, and throughout the entire 30 seconds, his phone number was pulsating across the bottom of the screen. Oscar watched with great curiosity but said nothing. Paula said, "Have you ever thought about advertising on television, Oscar? Seems like your firm needs to do something to get more business." This was not a new conversation. For 30 years, Paula had dispensed unsolicited advice on how to run the law office, a place that would never generate enough in revenue to satisfy her.
"It's very expensive," Oscar said. "Figg wants to pursue it. I'm skeptical."
"Well, you certainly couldn't put Figg on television, could you? That would scare away every potential client for 100 miles. I don't know. The ads just seem so unprofessional."
"Typical of Paula. TV advertising might bring in some business, and at the same time it was unprofessional." Was she for or against it? Neither or both. Oscar didn't know, and he'd stopped caring years earlier.
"Doesn't Figg have some Crayox cases?" she asked.
"A few, yes," Oscar grunted. She did not know that Oscar, as well as David, had signed the lawsuit and was responsible for its prosecution. She did not know that the firm was on the line for litigation expenses. Paula's only concern was the paltry monthly draw brought home by Oscar.
"Well, I discussed it with my doctor, and he says the drug is fine. It keeps my cholesterol under 200. I am not getting off the drug."
"Then you should not," he said. If Krayox did in fact kill people, he wanted her to keep taking the full daily dosage.
But there are lawsuits everywhere, Oscar. I'm still not convinced, are you?
She's loyal to the drug, but she's worried about the drug. Fig is convinced the drug causes damages, Oscar said. A lot of big law firms agree, and they're going after Varick. The general feeling is that the company will settle before going to trial. Too much at risk.
So, if there's a settlement, what happens to Fig's cases?
They're all death cases so far. 8 of them. If they settle, then we'll collect some nice fees.
How nice?
It's impossible to say. Oscar was already making plans. If and when the settlement talk became serious, he would move out, file for divorce, then try to keep her away from his Krayox money.
But I doubt they'll settle, he said.
Why not? Bosch here says there might be a big settlement.
Bosch is an idiot, and he proves it every day. These big pharmaceuticals usually go to trial a few times to test the waters. If they get hammered by juries, then they start settling. If they win, they keep trying the cases until the plaintiff's lawyers give up. This could take years.
Don't get your hopes up, dear. David and Helen Zink had been almost as amorous as Wally and Deanna. With David working shorter hours and their newfound energy, it had taken less than a week to become pregnant. Now that David was home at a decent hour every night, they made up for lost time. They had just finished a session and were lying in bed watching late-night TV when Bosch appeared on their screen. When he was gone, Helen said, "Looks like a frenzy."
"Oh, yes. Well, he's out there somewhere right now, littering the streets with brochures. It would be easier to advertise on television, but we can't afford it."
"Thank God for that. I really don't want to see you on screen fighting it out with the likes of Benny Bosch.
I think I'd be a natural as a TV lawyer. Have you been injured? We fight for you. Insurance companies fear us. What do you think?"
"I think your friends at Rogan Rothberg would howl with laughter."
"I have no friends there. Only bad memories."
"You've been gone, what, a month?"
6 weeks and 2 days, and I have not for one moment wanted to go back."
"And how much have you earned with your new firm?"
$620 and counting."
"Well, we do have an expansion underway. Have you thought about future earnings, things like that? You walked away from $300,000 a year, fine, but we can't live on $600 a month."
"Do you doubt me?"
"No, but a little reassurance would be nice."
"Okay. I promise you I'll make enough money to keep us happy and healthy, all three of us, or four, or five, or whatever."
"And how do you plan to do this?"
"TV. I'll go on the air to find Krayox victims," David said, laughing. "Me and Bosch. What do you think?"
"I think you're crazy."
They were both laughing, then groping.
Chapter 19. The official name of the gathering was a discovery conference, and it was typically a brief lawyer's get-together in front of the judge to discuss the initial stages of the lawsuit. No record was kept, just informal notes taken by a clerk. Often, and especially in the courtroom of Harry Seawright, the judge himself begged off and sent a magistrate to pinch hit. Today, however, Judge Seawright was presiding. As the senior judge in the Northern District of Illinois, he had a large courtroom, a splendid and spacious layout on the 23rd floor of the Dirksen Federal Building on Dearborn Street in downtown Chicago. The courtroom was lined with dark, oak-paneled walls, and there were plenty of thick leather chairs for the various players. On the right side, and to the judge's left, was the plaintiff's team of Wally Fig and David Zink. On the left side, and to the judge's right, was the team of about a dozen or so Rogan Rothberg lawyers toiling away on behalf of Varick Laboratories. Their leader, of course, was Nadine Karras, the only female lawyer present, and for the occasion she was modeling a classic Armani Navy suit, skirt just above the knees, nude legs, and designer platform pumps with 4-inch heels. Wally couldn't take his eyes off the shoes, the skirt, the entire package. "Maybe we should come to federal court more often," he'd quipped to David, who was in no mood for humor. Nor was Wally, to be honest. For both of them, it was their first venture into a federal courtroom. Wally claimed he handled cases in federal court all the time, but David was doubtful. Oscar, senior partner, who was supposed to be there with them, taking on the twin Goliaths of Rogan Rothberg and Varick, had called in sick. Oscar wasn't the only no-show. The great Jerry Alessandros and his team of world-class litigators were all lined up to blast into Chicago for an impressive display of strength, but a last-minute emergency hearing in Boston had become more important. Wally freaked out when he got the call from one of Alessandro's underlings. "It's just a discovery conference," the young man said. Driving to court, Wally had expressed skepticism about Zell and Potter. For David, the moment was extremely uncomfortable. He was sitting in a federal courtroom for the first time, knowing that he would not say a word because he had no idea what to say, and his opposition was a team of well-dressed and highly skilled lawyers from a firm he'd once been loyal to, a firm that had recruited him, trained him, paid him a top salary, and promised him a long career, and a firm that he had jilted, rejected, in favor of Finley and Fig? He could almost hear them snickering behind their legal pads. David, with his pedigree and Harvard diploma, belonged over there, where they billed by the hour, not on the plaintiff's side, where you beat the streets looking for clients. David did not want to be where he was, nor did Wally. Judge Seawright settled himself into his perch and wasted no time. "Where's Mr. Alessandros?" he growled in the direction of Wally and David. Wally jumped to his feet, offered a greasy smile, and said, "He's in Boston, sir." "So he will not be here today?" "That's right, Your Honor. He was on his way, but got sidetracked with some emergency in Boston." "I see. He's an attorney of record for the plaintiffs in this case. The next time we get together, tell him to be here. I will fine him $1,000 for missing the conference." "Yes, sir." "And you're Mr. Fig?"
"That's correct, Your Honor. And this is my associate, David Zink."
David tried to smile. He could almost see every Rogan Rothberg lawyer craning to have a look. "Welcome to federal court," the judge said sarcastically. He looked at the defense and said, "I suppose you're Ms. Karras?" She stood, and every eye in the courtroom locked onto her. "I am, Your Honor, and this is my co-counsel, Luther Hotchkin." "Who are all of those other people?"
"This is our defense team, Your Honor.
Do you really need all these people for a simple discovery conference?" Give him hell, Wally thought, still staring at the skirt.
"We do, indeed, Your Honor. This is a large and complicated case."
"So I've heard. You may keep your seats for the remainder of this hearing." Judge Seawright picked up some notes and adjusted his reading glasses. "Now, I've spoken to two of my colleagues in Florida, and we are not sure if these cases will proceed in a multi-district litigation. It appears as if the plaintiff's lawyers are having some difficulty getting themselves organized. Many, it seems, want a bigger piece of the pie, which is not surprising. At any rate, we have no choice but to proceed with discovery in this case. Mr. Fig, who are your experts?" Mr. Fig had no experts and had no idea when he might retain them. He was relying on the increasingly unreliable Jerry Alessandros to find the experts, because that's what he promised to do. Wally stood slowly, knowing that any hesitation would look bad.
"We'll have them next week, Your Honor. As you know, we are partnering with the law firm of Zell and Potter, a well-known firm specializing in mass torts. And with the flurry of activity around the country, it's been difficult to lock up the best experts. But we're definitely making progress."
"That's nice. Please sit down."
"So you actually filed this lawsuit before you consulted with any experts?" "Well, yes, Your Honor, and that's not unusual."
Judge Seawright doubted if Mr. Fig knew what was usual or unusual, but he decided not to embarrass the guy this early in the game. He picked up a pen and said, "You have 10 days to designate your experts. Then the defense will be allowed to depose them without delay."
"Yes, sir,"
Wally said, falling back into his chair. "Thank you. Now we have 8 death cases here, so we're dealing with 8 families. To start with, I want you to take the depositions of the personal representatives of all 8. Mr. Fig, when can you make these people available?"
"Tomorrow,"
Wally said. The judge turned to Nadine Karras and said, "That soon enough?" She smiled and said, "We prefer reasonable notice, Your Honor. I'm sure you have a busy trial calendar, Ms. Karras."
"As always, yes."
"And you also have unlimited resources. I count 11 lawyers taking notes right now, and I'm sure there are hundreds more back at the firm. These are just depositions, nothing complicated, so on Wednesday of next week you're going to depose 4 of the plaintiffs, and on Thursday you'll do the other 4. 2 hours max per plaintiff. If you need more time, we'll do them later. If you can't be there, Ms. Karras, just pick out 5 or 6 from your squad, and I'm sure they can handle the depositions."
I'll be there, Your Honor, she said coolly. Mr. Figg?
We'll be there.
I'll get my clerk to arrange the time, schedule, details, and we'll email it to you by tomorrow. Then, as soon as Mr. Figg designates his experts, we will schedule their depositions. Ms. Karras, when your experts are in place, please provide the necessary information, and we'll go from there. I want these initial depositions out of the way within 60 days. Any questions? There were none. He continued. Now, I have reviewed 3 other lawsuits involving this defendant and its products, and frankly, I'm not impressed with Varick's integrity or its ability to abide by the rules of discovery. The company, it seems, has a great deal of trouble turning over documents to the other side. It has been caught red-handed concealing documents. It has been sanctioned by judges at the state and federal levels. It has been embarrassed before juries and paid dearly with large verdicts, yet it continues to hide documents. At least 3 times, its executives have been charged with perjury. Ms. Karras, how can you assure me that your client will play by the rules? She glared at the judge, paused for a moment in a stare down, then said, I was not the attorney for Varick Labs in those other cases, Your Honor, and I don't know what happened there. I will not be tainted by lawsuits I had nothing to do with. I know the rules inside and out, and my clients always play by the rules. We'll see. Your client needs to be warned that I am watching closely. At the first hint of a discovery violation, I will haul the CEO into this courtroom and draw blood. Do you understand me, Ms. Karras?
I do.
Mr. Figg, you have not yet made a request for documents. When might this happen?
We're working on that now, Your Honor, Marley said, with as much confidence as possible. We should have it in a couple of weeks.
Alessandros had promised an exhaustive list of documents to be sought from Varick, but had yet to come through.
I'm waiting on you, Seawright said. This is your lawsuit. You filed it. Now let's get going.
Yes, sir,
Wally replied anxiously. Anything else? He asked.
Most of the lawyers shook their heads. His Honor seemed to relax somewhat as he chewed on the cap of his pen. He said,
I'm thinking this case might do well under Local Rule 8319. Have you considered this, Mr. Figg?
Mr. Figg had not, because Mr. Figg was not aware of Local Rule 8319. He opened his mouth, but only dry came forth. David quickly picked up the flag and spoke his first words in court.
We've considered that, Your Honor, but we have not yet discussed it with Mr. Alessandros. We should make a decision within the week.
Seawright looked at Nadine Karras and said, And your response?
We are the defense, Your Honor, and we are never eager to go to trial.
Her candor amused the judge. Wally whispered to David,
What the hell's Rule 8319?
David whispered back,
The rocket docket. Streamline the case. Balls to the wall.
We don't want that, do we?
Wally hissed.
No, we want to settle and cash in.
No need to file a motion, Mr. Figg, His Honor said. I'm placing this case in 8319 status. On the fast track, Mr. Figg, so let's get things moving along.
Yes, sir, Wally managed to mumble.
Judge Seawright tapped his gavel and said, We'll meet again in 60 days, and I expect Mr. Alessandros to be here. Adjourned. As David and Wally were stuffing files and notepads into their briefcases in hopes of a fast exit, Nadine Karras sauntered over for a quick hello.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Figg, Mr. Zink, she said with a smile that made Wally's nervous heart skip another beat.
A pleasure, he said.
David returned the smile as he shook her hand.
This promises to be a long, bruising fight, she said, with a lot of money on the table. I try to keep things on a professional level and hard feelings at a minimum. I'm sure your firm feels the same way.
Oh, yes, Wally gushed and almost asked her to go have a drink.
David wasn't as easily manipulated. He saw her as a pretty face and a warm facade, but just below the surface was a ruthless combatant who would enjoy watching you bleed in open court.
I guess I'll see you next Wednesday, she said. If not sooner, Wally said, a lame attempt at humor.
As she stepped away, David grabbed Wally by the arm and said,
Let's get out of here.
Chapter 20. Now that Helen was expecting and her future would be consumed with the baby, her studies at Northwestern seemed less important. She dropped one class because of morning sickness, and she was struggling with motivational problems in most of her others. David was pushing her delicately, but she wanted to take a break. She was almost 34, thrilled at the prospect of becoming a mother and losing interest quickly in a doctorate in art history. On a frigid day in March, they were having lunch in a cafe near the campus when Tony Vance, Helen's friend from class, happened to drop by. David had met her only once. She was 10 years older and had two teenagers and a husband who had something to do with containerized shipping. She also had the Burmese housekeeper with a grandson who was alive but probably brain damaged. David had urged Helen to push Tony to arrange a meeting, but the housekeeper had not been cooperative. Snooping, without violating laws or anyone's privacy, David had learned that the little boy was 5 years old and for the past 2 months had been in intensive care at the Lakeshore Children's Hospital on Chicago's North Side. His name was Tuya Kang, and he had been born in Sacramento, so he was a U.S. citizen. As for his parents, David had no way of knowing their immigration status. Zaw, the housekeeper, supposedly had a green card. "I think Zaw would talk to you now," Tony said as she sipped an espresso. "When and where?" David asked. She glanced at her watch. "My next class is over at 2, then I'll go home. Why don't you guys stop by?" At 2:30, David and Helen parked behind a Jaguar in the driveway of a striking contemporary house in Oak Park. Whatever Mr. Vance did with containerized cargo, he did it well. The house jutted here and there, up and down, with lots of glass and marble, and no discernible design. It tried desperately to be unique, and it succeeded greatly. They finally located the front door and were met by Tony, who'd found time to change outfits and was no longer trying to look like a 20-year-old student. She led them to a sunroom with full views of the sky and clouds, and moments later, Zaw entered with a tray of coffees. Introductions were made. David had never met a Burmese woman, but he guessed her age at 60. She was petite in her maid's uniform with short, graying hair and a face that seemed locked into a perpetual smile. "Her English is very good," Tony said. "Please join us, Zaw." Zaw awkwardly sat on a small stool near her boss. "How long have you been in the United States?" David asked.
20 years.
"And you have family here?"
"My husband is here, work for Sears. My son, too, work for a tree company."
"And he's the father of the grandson who's in the hospital?" She nodded slowly. The smile vanished at the mention of the boy.
"Yes."
"Does the boy have brothers and sisters?" She flashed two fingers and said,
"Two sister."
"Have they been sick too?"
"No."
"Okay. Can you tell me what happened when the boy got sick?" She looked at Tony, who said, "It's okay, Zaw. You can trust these people. Mr. Zink needs to hear the story." Zaw nodded and began talking, her eyes glued to the floor.
"He got real tired all the time, sleep a lot, then bad pain here."
She tapped her stomach.
"He cries so hard because of the pain. Then he start to vomit. Every day he vomit, and he lose weight, get real skinny. We take him to doctor. They put him in hospital, and he go to sleep."
She touched her head.
"They think he has brain problem."
"Did the doctor say it was lead poisoning?" She nodded.
"Yes."
No hesitation. David nodded too as he let this soak in. "Does your grandson live with you?"
"Next door, apartment."
He looked at Tony and asked, "Do you know where she lives?" "Rogers Park. It's an old apartment complex. I think everyone there is from Burma."
"Zaw, is it possible for me to see the apartment where the boy lives?"
She nodded.
"Yes."
"Why do you need to see the apartment?" Tony asked. "To find the source of the lead. Could be in the paint on the walls or in some of his toys. It might be in the water. I should have a look." Zoe rose quietly and said,
"Excuse me, please."
A few seconds later, she was back with a small plastic bag from which she removed a set of pink plastic teeth, complete with two large vampire fangs.
"He like these," Zaw said. "He scare his sisters, make funny noise."
David held the cheap toy. The plastic was hard and some of the coloring or paint had chipped off. "Did you see him play with these?"
"Yes, many time."
"When did he get these?"
"Last year. Halloween," she said, without the H sound. "I don't know if it make him sick, but he used them all the time. Pink, green, black, blue, many color."
"So there's a whole set of these?"
Yes.
Where are the others?
Apartment.
It was spitting snow when David and Helen found the apartment complex after dark. The buildings were 1960s-style blocks of plywood and tar paper, a few bricks on the steps, a few shrubs here and there. All the units were two stories, some with boarded windows and obviously abandoned. There were a few vehicles, all ancient imports from Japan. It was easy to get the impression that the place would have been condemned, with bulldozers to follow, but for the heroic efforts of the Burmese immigrants. Zal was waiting at 14B and led them a few steps to 14C. Toya's parents looked to be about 20 years old, but were really closer to 40. They looked exhausted, sad-eyed, and as frightened as any parents would be. They were appreciative that a real lawyer would come to their home, though they were terrified of the legal system and understood nothing about it. The mother, Lewin, hurried about preparing and serving tea. The father, Zaw's son, went by So, and as the man of the house did most of the talking. His English was good, much better than his wife's. As Zaw had said, he worked for a company that did all manner of tree work. His wife cleaned offices downtown. It was obvious to both David and Helen that there had been a lot of discussion before their arrival. The apartment was sparsely furnished but neat and clean. The only effort at decor was a large photograph of Aung San Suu Kyi, the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner and most famous dissident in Burma. Something was on the stove in the kitchen and its pungent aroma reeked of onions. In the car, the Zings had vowed not to stay for dinner in the unlikely event they were invited. Toy's two sisters were not to be seen or heard. The yellowish tea was served in tiny cups, and after a sip or two, So said, "Why do you want to talk to us?" David took his first sip, hoped it would be his last, and said, "Because if your son has in fact been poisoned by lead, and if the lead came from a toy or something here in the apartment, then you may, and I emphasize the word may, have a case against the maker of the dangerous product. I would like to investigate this matter, but I'm making no promises."
"You mean we could get money?"
"Possibly. That's the purpose of the case, or lawsuit, but first we need to dig a little deeper."
"How much money?"
Here, of course, Wally would promise them anything. David had heard him promise, or practically guarantee, $1 million or more to several of his Crayox clients.
"I can't answer that," David said. "It's too early. I would like to investigate, see if we can put together a case, and take it one step at a time."
Helen was watching her husband with admiration. He was doing a fine job in an arena where he knew nothing and had no experience. He'd never seen a lawsuit at Rogan Rothberg.
"Okay," Saw said. "What now?"
"Two things," David said. "First, I'd like to have a look at his things, toys, books, bed, anything that might be a source of lead. Second, I need for you to sign some papers that will allow me to begin accumulating his medical records."
So nodded at Lewin, who reached into a small box and removed a plastic Ziploc bag.
She opened it, and on the small coffee table lined up 5 pairs of fake teeth and fangs, blue, black, green, purple, and red. Zaw added the pink ones from the afternoon visit, and the set was complete.
"These called nasty teeth," So said.
David stared at the row of nasty teeth and, for the first time, felt a twinge of excitement of a big lawsuit. He picked up the green ones, hard but pliable plastic, flexible enough to open and close easily. He had no trouble seeing a pesky little brother with these in his mouth growling and snapping at his sisters.
"Your son played with these?" David asked.
Wynne nodded sadly. So said,
"He liked them, kept them in his mouth, tried to eat dinner with them one night."
"Who bought them?" David asked.
"I did," So said. "I bought a few things for Halloween. Cost not too much."
"Where did you buy them?" David asked, almost holding his breath. He hoped for an answer like Walmart, Kmart, Target, Sears, Macy's, some chain with deep pockets.
"At market," So said.
"What market?"
"Big mall near Logan Square."
Helen said, "Probably the Mighty Mall." And David's excitement waned a bit. The Mighty Mall was a hodgepodge of cavernous metal buildings housing a maze of cramped stalls and booths where one could find almost anything of legal value and many items from the black market. Cheap clothing, household goods, old albums, athletic gear, counterfeit CDs, used paperbacks, fake jewelry, toys, games, 1 million things.
The low prices attracted large crowds. Virtually all business was in cash. Record-keeping and receipts were not priorities.
"Did these come in a package?" David asked.
A package would provide the name of the manufacturer and maybe the importer.
"Yes, but it gone," So said. "In garbage, long time ago."
"No package," Luin added.
The apartment had two bedrooms, one used by the parents, the other by the children.
David followed So as the women stayed in the den. Toya's bed was a small mattress on the floor near his sister's. The children had a small, cheap bookcase filled with coloring books and paperbacks. Next to it was a plastic tub filled with boy toys.
"This his," So said, pointing to the tub.
"May I look through it?" David asked.
"Yes, please."
David dropped to his knees and slowly went through the box. Action figures, race cars, airplanes, a pistol, and handcuffs, the usual assortment of inexpensive toys for a 5-year-old boy. When he stood, he said, "I'll look at these later. For now, just make sure that everything stays here." Back in the den, the nasty teeth were ziplocked again. David explained that he would send them to an expert on lead poisoning and have them evaluated. If the teeth did indeed contain unsuitable levels of lead, then they would meet again and discuss the lawsuit. He cautioned that it might be difficult to pin down the maker of the toys, and he tried to dampen any enthusiasm for the thought of one day collecting money. The three, Zaw, Luin, and So, seemed as puzzled and apprehensive when the Zinks were leaving as they'd been when they arrived. So was on his way to the hospital to spend the night with Tuya. The following morning, David sent by overnight parcel the set of nasty teeth to a lab in Akron. Its director, Dr. Biff Sandroni, was a leading expert on lead poisoning in children. He also sent a check for $2,500, not from Finley and Fig, but from his personal bank account. David had yet to discuss the case with his two bosses and planned to avoid doing so until more was known. Sandroni called 2 days later to say he had received the package and the check, and that it would be a week or so before he could get around to testing the teeth. He was keenly interested because he had never seen a toy designed to be placed in the mouth. Virtually every toy he examined was one that a child chewed on for whatever reasons. The likely sources of the toy were China, Mexico, and India, and without the package it would be virtually impossible to determine the importer and manufacturer. Sandroni was a big talker and went on about his most significant cases. He testified all the time, loved the courtroom, and took full responsibility for several million-dollar verdicts. He called David David and insisted on being called Biff. As David listened, he could not remember another conversation with someone named Biff. The bluster would have worried David, but for his research into lead poisoning experts, Dr. Sandroni was a warrior with impeccable credentials. At 7 o'clock the next Saturday morning, David and Helen found the Mighty Mall and parked in a crowded lot. Traffic was thick, the place already busy. It was 30 degrees outside and not much warmer inside. They waited in a long line for beverages, bought 2 tall cups of hot cocoa, then began roaming. As chaotic as the market appeared, there was some semblance of organization. The food vendors were near the front, with such takeaway delicacies as Pronto Pups, donuts, and cotton candy drawing fans. Then a stretch of booths offering inexpensive clothing and shoes. Another long aisle was lined with books and jewelry, then furniture and auto parts. The shoppers, as well as the vendors, were of all shades and colors. Along with English and Spanish, there were many other languages. Asian tongues, something from Africa, then a loud voice that was probably Russian. David and Helen moved with the crowd, stopping occasionally to inspect something of interest. After an hour, and with the hot cocoa growing cooler, they found the household goods section, then the toys. There were 3 booths offering thousands of cheap gadgets and playthings, none of which resembled a set of nasty teeth. The Zinks were well aware they were months away from Halloween and were unlikely to find costumes and such. David picked up a package containing 3 different dinosaurs, all small enough for a toddler to chew on but too large to swallow. All 3 were painted shades of green. Only a scientist like Sandroni could scrape off the paint and test for lead, but after a month of exhaustive research, David was convinced that most of the cheapest toys were contaminated. The dinosaurs were sold by Larquette Industries, Mobile, Alabama, and made in China. He had seen the name Larquette as a defendant in several lawsuits.
As he held the dinosaurs, his mind was carried away by the absurdity of it all. A cheap toy is made 5,000 miles away, for pennies, decorated with lead paint, imported into the United States, passed along the distribution system until it lands here in a giant flea market, where it's offered for $1.99, where it's purchased by the poorest customers, taken home, presented to the child, who chews on it, then ends up in a hospital, brain damaged and ruined for life. Where are all of those consumer protection laws, inspectors, bureaucrats? Not to mention the hundreds of thousands of dollars required to treat the child and support him for his lifetime. "You buy?" the tiny Hispanic woman barked. "No thanks," David said, coming back to reality. He placed the toys back in the pile and turned away. "Any sign of nasty teeth?" he asked as he stepped behind Helen. "Not a thing. I'm freezing. Let's get out of here."
Chapter 21. As scheduled by Judge Seawright's clerk, the depositions of Finley and Figg's Crayox clients began promptly at 9 a.m. in a ballroom of the downtown Marriott. Since the defendant, Varick Labs, was picking up the tab for the depositions, there was a generous spread of rolls and pastries, along with coffee, tea, and juice. A long table had been arranged with a video camera at one end and a witness chair at the other. Iris Klopek was the first witness. She had called 911 the day before and rode in an ambulance to the hospital, where they treated her for arrhythmia and hypertension. Her nerves were shot, and she told Wally several times she could not go through with the lawsuit. He mentioned more than once that if she could tough it out, she would soon be receiving a large check, probably $1 million, and this helped somewhat. Also helping was a supply of Xanax, so when Iris took the witness chair and looked at the legion of lawyers, she was fairly glassy-eyed and drifting off to la-la land. Still, she at first froze and looked helplessly at her lawyer. "It's just a deposition," Wally had repeated. "There'll be a lot of lawyers there, but they're nice people for the most part." They didn't look nice. To her left was a line of intense young men in dark suits and frowns. They were already scratching away on their yellow legal pads, and she hadn't said a word. The nearest lawyer to her was an attractive woman who smiled and helped Iris settle down. To her right were Wally and his two sidekicks. The woman said, "Ms. Klopek, my name is Nadine Karras, and I'm the lead lawyer for Varick Labs. We're going to take your deposition over the next 2 hours, and I want you to try to relax. I promise I will not try to trick you. If you don't understand a question, don't answer it. I'll just repeat it. Are you ready?" "Yes," Iris said, seeing double. Next to Iris was a court reporter who said, "Raise your right hand." Iris did so, then swore to tell the truth. Ms. Karras said, "Now, Ms. Klopek, I'm sure your attorneys have explained that we are making a video of your deposition, and this might be used in court if for some reason you're unable to testify. Do you understand this?" "I think so." "So, if you look at the camera when you talk, we'll do just fine." "I'll try. Yes, I can do that." "Great. Ms. Klopek, are you currently taking any medication?" Iris stared at the camera as if waiting for it to tell her what to say. She took 11 pills a day for diabetes, blood pressure, cholesterol, erratic heartbeat, arthritis, kidney stones, and a few other ailments, but the one she worried about was Xanax because it could affect her mental state. Wally had suggested she skip any discussion about Xanax if asked the question, and here, right off the bat, Ms. Karras was digging. She giggled. "Sure, I'm on a lot of meds." It took 15 minutes to straighten them out, with no help from the Xanax, and just when Iris got to the bottom of the list, she remembered another one and blurted, "And I used to take Crayox, but not anymore. That stuff will kill you." Wally roared with laughter. Oscar thought it was funny, too. David suppressed a chuckle by looking directly across the table at the stone-faced boys from Rogan Rothberg, not a single one of whom would allow himself even a grin. But Nadine smiled and said, "Is that all, Ms. Klopek?" "I think so," she said, still not sure. "So you're taking nothing that would affect your judgment, memory, or ability to give truthful answers?" Iris glanced at Wally, who hid behind a legal pad, and for a second it was obvious that something was going unsaid. "That's correct," Iris said. "Nothing for depression, stress, panic attacks, anxiety disorders?" It was as if Ms. Karras were reading Iris's mind and knew she was lying. Iris was about to choke when she said,
Not normally.
10 minutes later, they were still grappling with not normally, and Iris finally admitted that she popped a Xanax every now and then. She proved sufficiently elusive, though, when Ms. Karras tried to pin her down on her Xanax use. She stumbled when she referred to the drug as her happy pills, but plowed on. In spite of her thick tongue and drooping eyelids, Iris assured the wall of lawyers to her left that she was clear-headed and ready to roll. Address, birth dates, family members, employment, education. The deposition quickly sank into tedium as Nadine and Iris fleshed out the Klopek family with emphasis on Percy, the departed. Iris, with increasing lucidity, managed to choke up twice when talking about her beloved husband, dead now for almost 2 years. Ms. Karras probed into Percy's health and habits, drinking, smoking, exercise, diet, and as much as she tried to whip the old boy into shape, Iris did a fair job of portraying him with accuracy. Percy came across as a fat, sick man who ate bad food, drank too much beer, and rarely left the sofa. "But he quit smoking," Iris added, at least twice. They took a break after an hour, and Oscar excused himself, saying he had to be in court, but Wally was suspicious. He had arm-twisted his senior partner to show up at the depositions, sort of a show of force in the face of the ground troops Rogan Rothberg would send in, though it was doubtful the presence of Oscar Finley would rattle the defense. When fully manned, the Finley and Fig side of the table had 3 lawyers, now minus one. 10 feet away, on the other side, Wally counted 8. 7 lawyers to sit and take the same notes while one did the talking? Ridiculous. But then Wally began thinking, as Iris droned on, that perhaps the show of force was a good thing. Perhaps Varick was so worried that they had instructed Rogan Rothberg to spare no expense. Maybe Finley and Fig had them on the ropes and didn't realize it. When they resumed the deposition, Nadine prompted Iris to begin talking about Percy's medical history, and Wally zoned out. He was still irritated that Jerry Alessandros had once again skipped the proceedings. At first, Alessandros had big plans to attend the depositions with his entourage, to make his first dramatic entrance into the case, to do battle with Rogan Rothberg and stake out some turf. But another last-minute urgency, this one in Seattle, proved more important. "It's only depositions," Alessandros told an agitated Wally on the phone the day before. "Pretty basic stuff." Basic indeed. Iris was talking about one of Percy's old hernias. David's role was limited. He was there as a warm body, a real lawyer taking up space, but with little to do but scribble and read. He was reviewing an FDA study on lead poisoning in children. Occasionally, Wally would politely say, "Objection, calls for conclusion." The lovely Ms. Karras would stop and wait to make sure Wally was finished. Then she would say, "You may answer, Ms. Klopek." And by then, Iris would tell her all she wanted to hear. Judge Seawright's strict 2-hour time limit was obeyed. Ms. Karras asked her last question at 10:58, then graciously thanked Iris for being such a good witness. Iris was going for her purse where the Xanax was kept. Wally walked her to the door and assured her she had done a superb job. "When do you think they'll want to settle?" she whispered. Wally put a finger to his lips and shoved her out. Next up was Millie Marino, widow of Chester, stepmother of Lyle, inheritor of the baseball card collection, and Wally's initial source of information about Crayox. Millie was 49, attractive, somewhat fit, reasonably well-dressed, and apparently unmedicated, a far cry from the last witness. She was there for her depo, but she was still not a believer in the lawsuit. She and Wally were still bickering over her late husband's estate. She was still threatening to pull out of the lawsuit and find another lawyer. Wally had offered to guarantee, in writing, a $1 million settlement. Ms. Karras asked the same questions. Wally made the same objections. David read the same memo and thought, "Only 6 more after this one." After a quick lunch, the lawyers reconvened for the deposition of Adam Grand, the assistant manager of an all-you-can-eat pizza house whose mother had died the previous year after taking Crayox for 2 years. It was the same pizza house Wally now frequented, but only to secretly leave copies of his Beware of Crayox brochures in the restrooms. Nadine Karras took a break, and her number 2, Luther Hotchkin, handled the deposition. Nadine, though, apparently loaned him her questions because he asked the same ones. During his insufferable career at Rogan Rothberg, David had heard many tales about the boys in litigation. The litigators were a breed apart. wild men who gambled with huge sums of money, took enormous risks, and lived on the edge. In every large law firm, the litigation section was the most colorful and filled with the biggest characters and egos. That was the urban legend, anyway. Now, as he glanced occasionally across the table at the solemn faces of his adversaries, he had serious doubts about the legend. Nothing he had ever experienced in his career was as monotonous as sitting through depositions, and this was only his third one. He almost missed the drudgery of plodding through the financial records of obscure Chinese corporations. Ms. Karras was taking a break, but she missed nothing. This early round of depositions was nothing more than a little contest, a pageant to provide her and her client the opportunity to meet and examine the eight contestants and select a winner. Could Iris Klopek withstand the rigors of an intense two-week trial? Probably not. She was stoned during her depo, and Nadine had two associates already working on her medical records. On the other hand, some jurors might have great sympathy for her. Millie Marino would make an impressive witness, but her husband, Chester, could potentially have the strongest link to heart disease and death. Nadine and her team would finish the depots, watch them again and again, and slowly eliminate the better ones. They and their experts would continue to dissect the medical records of the eight victims and eventually select the one with the weakest claim. When they picked their winner, they would race to court with a thick, cold-blooded, and well-reasoned motion to separate. They would ask Judge Seawright to take the single case they wanted, place it on his rocket docket, and clear all obstacles between it and a trial by jury.
Minutes after 6 p.m., David bolted from the Marriott and almost ran to his car. He was punch drunk and needed his lungs full of cold air. Leaving downtown, he stopped at a Starbucks in a strip mall and ordered a double espresso. Two doors down was a party store that advertised costumes and favors, and, as had become his habit, he wandered over for a look. No party store was safe from him or Helen these days. They were searching for a set of nasty teeth in the wrapper with names of corporations in fine print. This one had the usual inventory of cheap costumes, gag gifts, decorations, glitter, toys, wrapping paper. There were several sets of vampire teeth made in Mexico and sold by a company called Mirage Novelties of Tucson. He was familiar with Mirage, even had a small file on the company. Privately owned, sales last year of $18 million, most of its products along the same lines of what David was now inspecting. He had files on dozens of companies that specialized in cheap toys and gadgets, and his research was growing daily. What he had not found was another set of nasty teeth. He paid $3 for a set of fangs to add to his growing collection, then drove to the Brickyard Mall where he met Helen at a Lebanese restaurant. Over dinner, he refused to describe his day. The same ordeal was planned for tomorrow, so they chatted about her classes and, not surprisingly, the coming addition to their family. Lakeshore Children's Hospital was nearby. They found the ICU, then found So Kang in a visitor's room. He had relatives with him, and introductions were made, though neither David nor Helen caught a single name. The Burmese were visibly touched that the Zinks would stop by and say hello. Tuya's condition had changed little in the past month. The day after their visit to the family's apartment, David had contacted one of the doctors. After he emailed the paperwork signed by So and Nguyen, the doctor was willing to talk. The boy's outlook was bleak. The level of lead in his body was highly toxic, with substantial damage to his kidneys, liver, nervous system, and brain. He was in and out of consciousness. If he survived, it would take months or years to gauge the level of impaired brain activity. Normally, though, with this much lead, children did not survive. David and Helen followed So down the hall, past a nurse's station, and to a window where they could see Tuya strapped to a small bed and hooked to an astonishing assortment of tubes, lines, and monitors. His breathing was aided by a respirator. "I touch him once a day. He hear me," So said, then wiped the moisture from his cheeks. David and Helen stared through the window, but could think of nothing to say. Chapter 22. Another aspect of big firm life that David had learned to despise was the endless meetings. Meetings to evaluate and review, to discuss the firm's future, to plan everything, to greet new lawyers, to say goodbye to old ones, to stay current on the law, to mentor rookies, to get mentored by senior partners,
to talk about compensation, labor issues, and an endless list of other incredibly boring topics. The Rogan Rothberg culture was nonstop work and nonstop billing, but there were so many useless meetings that the making of money was actually often impeded. With that in mind, David reluctantly suggested his new firm have a meeting. He'd been there 4 months and had settled into a comfortable routine. He was worried, though, about the lack of civility and communication among the other members of the firm. The Crayox litigation was dragging on. Wally's dreams of a quick jackpot were fading and revenue was down. Oscar was increasingly more irritable, if that was possible. In gossiping with Rochelle, David learned that the partners never sat around the table to think strategically and to air complaints. Oscar said he was too busy. Wally said such a meeting was a waste. Rochelle thought the idea was awful until she realized she would be invited. Then she became enamored with the idea. As the only non-lawyer employee, she thought the idea of being allowed a soapbox was appealing. With time, David was able to cajole the senior and junior partners, and Finley and Fig scheduled its inaugural firm meeting. They waited until 5 p.m., then locked the front door and put the phones on hold. After a few awkward moments, David said, "Oscar, as the senior partner, I think you should run the meeting." "What do you want to talk about?" Oscar shot back. "Glad you asked," David said as he quickly passed around an agenda. "Number one, fee schedule. Number two, case review. Number three, filing. Number four, specialization." "This is just a suggestion," David said. "Frankly, I don't care what we talk about, but it's important for each of us to be able to unload." "You spent too much time in a big firm," Oscar said. "So what's bugging you?" Wally asked David. "Nothing's bugging me. It's just that I think we could do a better job of keeping our fees uniform and reviewing each other's cases. The filing system is 20 years out of date, and as a firm, we're not going to make money if we don't specialize."
"Well, speaking of money," Oscar said, picking up a notepad, "since we filed these Crayox cases, our gross has declined for 3 straight months. We're spending far too much time on those cases, and our cash is getting low. That's what's bugging me." He was staring at Wally.
"The payoff's coming," Wally said.
"That's what you keep saying.
We'll settle the groomer car wreck next month and net around 20 grand. It's not unusual to go through a dry period, Oscar. Hell, you've been doing this a long time. You know the ups and downs. Last year we lost money 9 months out of 12, and we still showed a nice profit."
There was a loud knock on the front door. Wally jumped to his feet and said,
"Oh no, it's Deanna. Sorry, guys. I told her to take the day off."
He raced to the door and opened it. She made her entrance, skin-tight black leather pants, hooker's heels, tight cotton sweater.
Wally said, "Hey, honey, we're having a little meeting. What say you wait in my office?"
"How long?" she asked.
"Not long."
Deanna smiled like a tart at Oscar and David as she strutted by. Wally led her to his office and closed her inside. He sat down at the table slightly embarrassed.
"Know what's bugging me?" Rochelle asked.
"Her," she nodded.